This is Global Torah, conversations and meditations on global Jewish service and international development. I'm your host, Shani Rosenbaum, bringing you today my live recorded conversation with Dr. Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg and Yerdan Zornberg at Limud UK in Birmingham, England. In my mind, the beauty of Global Torah rests on a core Jewish concept that the dialogue between Limud and Maaseh, between study and action, can inform and enhance both our study and our action in the world. The dialogue you're about to hear is a dialogue between study and action, but it's also another crucial form of dialogue, intergenerational dialogue. When it comes to both study and social action, the exchange of insight and experience between generations can be extremely valuable and often extremely challenging. So today we're going to give it a try. We'll hear two separate approaches to one text, the Book of Ruth, and what that text has to teach us about the encounter with the other. We'll first hear some reflections on the text from Yerdan Zornberg, director of Project 10, which is a global Jewish Peace Corps that operates volunteer centers for young Jews throughout the developing world. Yerdan will share with us ways his experience in the field have illuminated his reading of Ruth. After that, we'll hear a shiur, an in-depth examination of Ruth, from acclaimed biblical scholar Dr. Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg, who is also Yerdan's mother. And once we've heard both separate perspectives, we'll have some time for conversation, for Aviva and Yerdan to reflect on what they've learned from one another. Ready? Let's dive in. Here's Yerdan.
Hi. Just a word about the process that led to this session. Shani wrote a mail about 4 months ago, it was, asking if I would like to have a session with my mother in at Limud. And my first response was pretty much to be terrified. And luckily, there was a very smart woman sitting next to me when I got the mail, and I told her about her name is Esti Moskovich, and she said, you cannot miss this opportunity. And that got me thinking. I think like the basis of the being terrified was that I feel my look into text is very action-oriented, even like it's the Limud is only a tool for taking action. And I feel that my mother does a lot of Limud L'shem Limud, like going deep inside into the figures. And I was wondering how those two things can really come together. And then we had a kind of ping-pong when I was pushing my mother to do it, and then it changed around when she wanted to do it and I wanted less. And I think at this point I'm more excited than terrified. And I think the process was really a good process. So it was thank you for the early morning chavrutas over the past few months, and thank you, Shani, for making this happen.
Okay, let me come in now from my very different angle of perception. I'm interested in the inner life. That's a really presumptuous thing to say. It's partly an excuse, it's an alibi, for not doing the kind of work that my son does. So I really do feel that in some way he has fulfilled the unfulfilled part of me, that I spend most of my time at a desk. I spend most of my time preparing and thinking and dreaming, literally dreaming, that is, at night, dreaming about what I want to talk about. And so I am kind of internally turned. And then I face classes, and I have to put it out there, but it's all words. And here is my son actually doing it. He's out there in the world. And that causes a complex array of feelings in me. It's on the whole, very positive feelings, a feeling of joy.
Just a word about Project 10, so we can understand the context that the way I look into the Megillah. So Project 10 was created 5 years ago, and we do two things. We create and operate volunteer centers in developing areas around the world, and we have centers in Ghana, in Uganda, in South Africa, in Mexico, in the north of Israel, in Arduf, and next year, hopefully, in Myanmar, Burma, and Peru. And there's two pillars to these centers. The first pillar is basically to create sustainable projects with and for the local population. And we have three fields that we work in. We work in agriculture, health, and informal education. And in each one of them, we've developed models of intervention that we copy from center to center with adjustments to the local culture and local needs. The second pillar is we want to create a platform for young Jewish adults to get together and do something significant together. Maybe in the big vision, create a relevant Jewish vision that is a global one, as we realize that many of young Jewish adults have an interest in not only being inside the Jewish community, but kind of looking outside and being part of the global world. And we want to create an equation where you can be a global citizen, a global activist, but still do it out of a Jewish pair of glasses, a Jewish set of values, and we can see how their motivations can come from Jewish text. The reason we chose Megillat Rut is, I think it brings something together. My mother had a class on Megillat Rut, and the way we look at it is a Megillah that talks about otherness or strangers on one hand and chesed on the other hand. So that fits in very well with what we do in Project 10. So I'll try to go into a bit into otherness and a bit into chesed. A few points.
Chesed meaning compassion.
Chesed, compassion. Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to bug you.
Yeah, bug me. So otherness. So there's a lot of otherness in the Megillah. There's Elimelech and Naomi in Bethlehem, who leave to Moab, and the commentary says that they were actually a rich family. They were not leaving really because of the hunger. They were probably leaving because maybe they're being harassed and asked for money and asked for food and so on. And they separate themselves from the local Bethlehem people, and they leave for Moab. And then, of course, they're strangers in Moab, and at the end they also marry into their sons marry Moabian girls. And then, of course, when Ruth and Naomi make their way to Bethlehem, there's actually a kind of imaginary junction, because they leave Moab, and then they have a, if you can imagine, a kind of junction. And they stop there, and they have this discussion where Naomi tells Ruth, Shuvna, or tells Ruth and Orpah, Shuvna three times, go back to your country. You have nothing to come with me for. I will have no sons to give you to marry, and you will not be able to bring children. And you're going to be a foreigner there. You can be a foreigner in Bethlehem. Why don't you go back to your home? And there's a kind of shifting of being in the other, or being the stranger there. Like, if Naomi was a stranger and the other in Moab, on this junction it kind of switches around, and suddenly Ruth becomes the stranger. Yeah, and there's a kind of, in otherness, this, like you see in the Megillah, the kind of a push and pull, kind of like of attraction to the other, and there's a kind of pushing away or repulsion from the other. And you can see it, like in the Peshat, when you read it, it seems like Naomi worries about Ruth and wants her to go back. She's caring for her. She says, you're not going to have a good life in Bethlehem. You should go back to where you'll have a good life. But when you really look into the words, you can see that, to some extent, Naomi is trying to get rid of Ruth. She's like, she doesn't want that burden of coming back to Bethlehem with a stranger, with the burden of taking care of somebody, and she's kind of pushing her away. And that's the context also of conversion. Like, when a convert wants to become a Jew, he's in a room there, and it's very clear that he's there to join. But then the rabbi says, Shuvna, or shuv, like go back. And after three times, if the person still insists, then we bring him in. And it's also kind of like, we're bringing you in, we're in the room to bring you in, but we're also pushing you away, and it's kind of push and pull there. I feel that to some extent in our work, our volunteers come in with they're attracted to the other, going to Uganda, meeting different cultures, working with them on certain issues that they feel they have tools to work on. And it's very exciting for them. But then once they get there, there's a lot of difficulty that arises. There's behaviors that are offensive that we meet, and we discuss in the other sessions we gave over the past few days. Like endless examples, but hitting children in class or other things and so on, which are suddenly like, okay, I'm a bit appalled from this otherness or strange behaviors. And it's also to the looks and the poor people on the street, and sometimes even to the smell. Like, I don't know if some of you know the smell of injera in Ethiopia. And people are like, oh, this is a sour smell. It's like, so it's also kind of push and pull. They're there, they're excited to be there, but it's also something to discover that there's a gap there. There's something that's bothering them. So that's one point about otherness. The second point is that otherness arouses process on both sides. We can see that with the volunteers, they come there and they're definitely others. And when they work together in the projects, there's something that happens to the locals just from us being others. Like one example that I have is we had a mobile school in Gondar, Ethiopia, which was a cart. We opened to a 6-meter board, and we used to give classes in the main squares for the street children, and in mathematics, English, the local language, sports, and so on. Like these are children that don't go to school. And after 2 years of working with this project together with local teachers, we did the fade out process, which is basically we lead first and we lead together, and then at some point it's supposed to go onwards to the local NGO. And we did that process. But after 6 months, the NGO actually asked us to step back in, because the children were less interested to come to the mobile school if there's not an other there. So we're not happy with this call back in, and we're still trying to understand what the best way will be to pass it on. But there is a motivation to learn that comes just from meeting the other, just from seeing somebody stranger and, oh, this is interesting, and, okay, I want to learn from you. And on the other hand, the otherness in the Jewish volunteers, somewhat the encounter with a different culture that is very different, a different identity that is very different, creates a process, in the process. I used to sometimes, when I spoke to donors, say, like, when was this Jewish identity strongest? And I put there, like, the kind of a assumption that before the Israeli state was founded. Because when Jews were living, like, face-to-face with Eastern European communities and so on, and it was very different, it kind of pushed them to an inner process of trying to understand who they are. And we can see that very clearly happening with volunteers. When they meet a very different culture and something happens within them, they start, like, okay, they have this culture and they have these traditions. Okay, what am I? Like, who am I? And we can see with a lot of young Jewish adults, and we get a lot of unaffiliated Jewish adults who want to volunteer in the world, and they understand that they can do it through a Jewish organization. But they don't come there for the Jewish part. And then if there's a good project and a good relationship with the local people, then it pushes inwards to have something that happens inside. And the third thing that happens is the kind of flipping of otherness. Clearly the volunteers, the others in the place where we are. But when we step into the class and we're teaching English or computers, suddenly the volunteers are feeling they're in their zone, they're in their area, they know what they're doing, and the locals are the strangers that are kind of trying to understand what's going on, what are these new skills that they are learning. The second part of chesed is, or compassion, like the way we see chesed is that it's beyond tzedek. Like tzedek is the rule, okay? You have to do leket, shechecha, and pe'ah. You have to leave parts of your field for the poor, and it's a law. It's the Jewish law. And chesed is somehow stepping beyond the border of just what you're supposed to do. And many times it's towards the others, because towards your family and friends, you know you're supposed to help, and you know you want to help, you want to do the extra mile. But when you do it to somebody who's an other, who's not you or who you define yourself with your friends and your family, that's where chesed comes in. And there's a stepping over a border there. Like there's the story my mother told me while we were studying of when her father died, passed away. these two women who were, they not friends, were they like...
Acquaintances.
Acquaintances. They came in and just washed the floors of the house. And the mother was like a bit like held back at first. Was like, oh, okay, they're like, this is something very private. But on the overall, she felt this is really nice. Like they're really like, and it's stepping. It's a chesed because it's stepping beyond the border. What it's supposed to say, like come in and say whatever you say, and bring a bit of food and so on. It's like it's stepping beyond. So of course, the volunteers step beyond the border, the physical borders of their country, if it's North America or if it's Israel or Europe and so on. Another thing about chesed that the Beit Yaakov says, he says, like, when you do a chesed, you have to make sure that the one accepting the chesed does a small step towards you. Like, yeah, he does even a small hint that he wants this. And you can see it with Naomi and Ruth. Naomi could have tried to get rid of Ruth already in Moab. Like, why did they say they? Oh, you can see the source page. They leave Moab and they're at a junction. That's sort of an action on Naomi's side, showing I actually do want you to come, but I don't want you to come. But there is the first step of kind of I'm interested in your chesed. I'm interested in your chesed. And that's something that us in our field, we make sure that happens in all our projects. We do not work with passive communities, or we do not impose projects on locals without them being active and part of it and showing interest. And all our projects are roofed by local NGOs. We do not have any project that we own ourselves. We do not open a community center and say, hey, guys, come study whatever. It's either we join into what they do and try to enhance the activity, or if we have an idea for a project or one of our models, we make sure we find a local NGO that is interested in it, that wants to roof it and will gradually and at some day take over the project. Another thing about chesed, and you can see it also in the Megillah, when Boaz is clearly doing a chesed with Ruth, he lets her do a field, he lets her have food, then at the end he's willing to marry her, willing to take her out of her strangerhood. And it seems very clear that he's the doer and she's accepting. But then if you look at the words on the source sheet, it says, Boaz says, "Chesed asher asit imi, gadol me'chesed asher asit." It's like, it's a bit confusing. Like,
English.
Translate it. What did I say? Chesed, the compassion that you did with me is bigger than the chesed or the compassion. And it's a bit confusing because it seems like it's very clear that Boaz is doing the chesed. He's not accepting the chesed. And even Ruth, who's accepting the chesed, which goes back to Naomi, she says, "Asher asiti imo." I did it with him. Which is also, it shows that the chesed is somehow happens in a two-way, street. And clearly, we can feel it very strongly when we volunteer in these remote places. We're coming in to do chesed and trying to create real, sustainable, effective, accountable projects with and for the local population. But to some extent, we always feel we're getting sometimes at least as much. There's an Indian Swami, who's kind of like a spiritual leader. His name is Vikananda, and he says, no beggar that we helped doesn't owe us anything, a dime, it says. We owe him everything because he allowed us to practice tzedakah through him. And we feel very clearly. We feel like the volunteers come back, and they come back inspired, and they come back with a social action vision of what they want to do. We consider changing the course of lives a lot of time, what they want to do and how they want to do it. So we make sure that the projects are our first goal, and we believe that if the projects are good projects and effective ones, the side effect of that will be the chesed coming back in the other direction. And closing up my reading of the Megillah, there's in chapter 4, there's this kind of strange change of the story when suddenly the whole chesed, the compassion, becomes din. There's a kind of court, and there's somebody who's a legal person who's supposed to... Liabem, you want to try that in English?
redeem a widow from her needing to marry the closest kin.
It's a legal process.
There's a legal process over the land and over redeeming her and so on. And suddenly it becomes a very kind of tzedek kind of process.
Justice.
And we're hoping that one day the chesed that organizations like ours and AJWS of Ruth Messenger and many, many others will become something that is kind of like, if not a din in Jewish culture and identity and law, then at least a custom that every Jew thinks about and maybe takes part, maybe young Jewish adults, they can go to Taglit, Masa, or go volunteer in the world, or do both. And we'll be part of like something that Leket Shechra Pe'a in Tikkun Olam. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, that's a hard act to follow. I want to start at one of the points that Yarden made. Shovna, Shovna, Shovna. What Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, her Moabite daughters-in-law, on the road at the junction, when she wants to persuade them to return. And she uses the word, aside from everything that Yarden said, I want to add this nuance. She's saying, return, return, return. Go back home, and it'll be better for you. You have nothing to look for if you come with me. She says, for instance, Shovna isha bet ima, isha le bet ima, each woman to the house of her mother. Go back to where you really come from, your place of origin, where your mothers are. And then again, your future, not only your past, but your future. Isha, bet, isha. Isha, right, it's a play on words. Isha and isha. Each woman to the house of her man. Aleph, Yud, Shin. Your future man, that is. I assume you're relatively young. I assume you'll want to remarry your young widows. Only there can you do it. Don't come back with me. There is no future for you with me. And the point I wanted to add in connection with this is that she is using the word lashuv, to return, properly. That's what the word means, to go back to where you actually come from. Whereas when the young women reply, when the women reply, they say, they use the word shuv improperly. They say, no, we want to go back with you, as if you can go back to a place where you've never been. I want to go back to Bethlehem, which is where you come from and where you're going back to. So, of course, logically it makes sense, because what it means is your point of origin, you know, you're going back to where you come from, and I want to accompany you on your act of return. At the same time, they keep on saying, we want to return. And then one of them drops out, Orpah drops out, and kisses her mother-in-law goodbye. Verut dafkaba. And Ruth clings to her. There's some kind of, I want to bring this up later, there's some kind of stickiness about Ruth. That she, there's something about her that's adhesive, that's attached. And she's attached to her mother-in-law, and she says no, and she keeps on repeating, we want to return with you. Which is in a way an absurd statement, if you can hear it. That you can't return to a place where you've never been. So Naomi becomes the effective subject here, that she is the one who's returning. So what is Ruth doing? And the implication is that you can return to a place of imagination, somewhere, a place of a yearning that is not based on any empirical reality, but somehow it's a yearning in Ruth, a kind of irrational yearning in her, to return to the place, to the Holy Land, which is a place she's never been. It's a place of dream, perhaps. It's a place of associations. It's an inner world in Ruth that is expressing itself here. Now, I think, and this is one of the main points that I'd like to make by way of introduction, I think that there is a text that lies behind the Book of Ruth without which you can't understand the story. In the traditional view, the text that lies behind the Book of Ruth is a text from Deuteronomy, Lo yavo amoni u'moavi b'kahal Hashem. No Ammonite or Moabite may ever enter into the community of God. That's a real ban, right? It's a taboo. That's the reason why Ruth has nothing to look for in terms of marriage if she goes back to the Jewish country, to the land of Judea, because no one can marry her. Now, the traditional view, reading, has always been that everyone knows this. It's never said specifically in the text, but that everyone is aware of this ban, of this taboo. And that's what gives the bite to the whole story, that Ruth is really going against her best interests, that she's turning her back on where she rightfully belongs and where she has a future, to do this mad thing of following her mother-in-law in somewhere in fantasy. There's a kind of fantasy element in her attachedness. It's not a personal attachment only, it seems to me, as it comes out very clearly in what she says when she's arguing with her mother-in-law, and Naomi is trying to persuade her to return. And she says, no, yeah, Amech Ami, Elokayach Elokai, your God is my God, your people are my people. Right? It's not just Ruth's person that she's attached to. It's everything she imagines through Naomi. Did I say Ruth? No, it's not Naomi's person, but everything that she associates with, of which she really hasn't necessarily had any experience yet. She doesn't know her people. She's not part of them in any sense. And she knows she can never marry. That's the understood meaning of no Ammonite or Moabite can ever enter into lo yavo. That's going to be very important for us. Cannot come. It's a very basic Hebrew expression, biblical expression, to come, lavo. And I want to be a little daring here, a bit provocative, and to say that as in English, the word lavo in Hebrew has a sexual connotation. Yes, the word to come has a sexual connotation in English. Lo yavo doesn't mean no one can enter into the territory of where the Jewish people are living. Lo yavo means specifically not to marry into. So to come means to enter into the flesh and blood tissue, yeah, of the Jewish people, who will become the Jewish people. Now that is forever banned. So it seems an unequivocal taboo. I imagine it like a placard up over the gate of Bethlehem, saying Lo yavo. As Ruth enters there, she knows she is going against the stream. She's going upstream somehow. That's part of the irony and the tension and the tragedy of the opening of the story. Because I think there is a tragic aspect to the story. And it comes out right away in the first thing she says, Ruth says to Boaz, weeping amid the alien corn, as the poet John Keats, the English poet John Keats, dreamed Ruth, right? In one of his great poems, he describes Ruth weeping amid the alien corn. Now, that's not written in the text. There's no reference to her weeping. What do we have that suggests melancholy, that suggests a terrible loneliness? And that's what you talk about otherness. I think the first experience of otherness, in this case, not always, is absolute aloneness. That one feels completely isolated from one's kind. And here, what does she say to Boaz? She bows down to the ground. She falls on her face. Boaz has been very kind to her and opened up to her her legitimate rights in the field. You know, and told her how she should go about collecting, as it were, her social rights. The gleanings in the field, the corner of the field is for her because she is other, she's a stranger, she is a declassed person. She's not only a stranger and a Moabite, but she is a widow, she has no man to protect her, she is poor. Right, with all these things against her, she then bows down to Boaz in recognition and in thanks. And she says to him, Madua matzati chen be'enecha lahakireni v'anochi nochriya. I'm playing it up a little bit. If you notice the gutturals, Madua matzati chen be'enecha lahakireni v'anochi nochriya. You know, you can hear the bitterness and the loneliness of her situation. I am, after all, a stranger. I am an outsider. I am strange to you. I'm different from you. Why have I found favor in your eyes to seem to know me? And that's a very intriguing expression, that you are actually knowing me. You are acting in some kind of strange recognition of me. You are treating me like a human being whom you know on some level, as if we belong to the same kind. You're talking to me like a human being. He indeed talked to her with great recognition of her chesed. He goes on to praise her and say, you're famous already among us for your kindness to your mother-in-law. In other words, he gives her a story to inhabit. And she is very grateful and a little mystified in a way. How come you're expressing in a way a kind of affinity with me when in fact I'm a total stranger, and there is no way you can possibly know me. That is the paradox of her situation. That on the one hand, she always wanted to find, she said before she went out that day to glean in the fields, she said, I'll find someone in whose eyes I will find favor. You know, we don't often focus on that. In other words, she's pretty confident that when it comes to what happens between people, that she's quite good at that. You know, that people, there will be someone who will recognize her in a way, who will recognize her as a human being. She's good at coming out that way. Maybe there's something even a little brazen about it. That's that confidence that wherever I go, I'll... And here she is saying to him, why have I found favor in your eyes? And I would think, in a way, from my rather mischievous associations, I would think part of it is that she's telling him, I see I found favor in your eyes. In other words, he now realizes that she has found favor in his eyes. Maybe he didn't know it before she said it. You know, that actually I like her. I like this woman. I respect her. And once she's said it in this way, this humble way, she has brought it up. And now he understands. And there's something about the dynamic then between people who are absolutely nochri one to the other. There could be no one more nochri, more different than Ruth. And she's immediately weaving somewhere threads of connection between herself and Boaz, this rich landowner. More than that, the first source on your page gives you a midrash on what she maybe, on some unconscious level, is also saying. She falls on her face, she bows down to the ground, and she says what she says about knowing me. This teaches you that she prophesied that he would, in the future, know her in the way of the whole world. Now, when it says in the way of the whole world, what does it mean? Derech kol ha'aretz? Sexually. Yeah. In other words, a very daring level here of interpretation. Then the Midrash is giving us a Ruth who is in a way hinting to Boaz. She has the confidence and in a way a certain kind of, what can I call it?
Gumption.
Gumption, yeah. Otherwise known as chutzpah, yes, to actually say to him, you know, we're going to know each other very well one day. You know, we are going to have a kind of most intimate knowing. And that comes from the idea of what we call biblical knowledge, yes, that Adam knew his wife Eve, and you have the idea that knowing can refer to the sexual area. So here the rabbinic word, lahakir, is used instead of ladat, and you get the same idea. And the sages are daring enough to suggest that Ruth knows in some way. Not because, it says she prophesied. I don't think she's a prophet. If she really knew how things were going to turn out, then that would take the point out of the whole story. The whole effect of the story depends on the fact that she takes risks and he takes risks, that there is much not knowing of each other, that they don't really know each other at all. They really are strange to each other. And nevertheless, there is some deep intuition of some kind which leads Ruth to behave in a certain way, in a way responding to the radiations of the future. Now, I'm using that expression, the radiations of the future, because it pleases me. I like that expression. I borrowed it, actually, from a French Jewish philosopher, André Néer, and I've adopted it as my own. That is, she has a sense about the significance of this meeting, that something here is going to develop. And given that sense, the sages are willing to acknowledge that Ruth is here, in a way, preparing the future. She's not just... What I want to do next is to look with you very quickly, and this is one of the places where we're going to have to sacrifice, at a cluster of three midrashic sources, numbers 3, 4, and 5 on your page. You can cast your eye over them, and I'll paraphrase rather loosely. What we have here is a midrashic tradition, complex tradition, about what happens next in the story. What happens next is that Naomi sends Ruth, months later, time has passed, at the end of the barley harvest, to go to meet Boaz on the threshing floor at night, at midnight, and to lie down at his feet. That's a very brazen thing for someone to do, for a woman to do. Here, Ruth, in a way, is acting out her brazen paternity, her nationality. Moab, one of the strikes against Moab is that they are sexually very, dissolute. But not Moab, the daughters of Moab. Where the nationality was created by Lot's forced relationship with his daughter after the destruction of Sodom, where the daughter initiates him, makes her father drunk, and has relations with him, and then has gumption, to name her child Me'avi, from my father. In other words, the incest, Moab, comes from this tradition, comes from an absolutely blatant acknowledgement that it was an act of incest. That someone coming from that background is delegitimized somewhere in our... We don't look for people like that. Also someone who lacks chesed. Moab is also notorious for refusing food and water in the desert to the Israelite people. With two strikes against her, it seems that on the one hand, she has enormous potential of loving kindness, and that she uses that chutzpah, she's very forward going. She's not reticent. In a very interesting mixture with a kind of modesty. So she's going to come and lie down there, and she comes and she uncovers his feet and she lies down. It's really a strange scene. And it was at midnight, the man shuddered and he felt himself gripped. She's gripping his feet very tight, and he shudders as he shudders awake, very strong word. And behold, there was a woman lying there at his feet. So you get the sense of his coming to himself, out of the darkness, out of sleep, having eaten and drunk a good meal to celebrate the harvest. He begins to return to himself as she wakes him. And his first thought is, oh, it's a woman. He shudders, and then he says, oh, it's a woman. What did he think it was before he thought it was a woman? So the Midrashic tradition says, blithely, it was perhaps a demon. Demons haunt threshing floors after successful harvests. You know, if you have a celebration, watch out, the bad fairy is likely to turn up, right? So there's always an edge of danger to success. And here is Boaz, a lonely man, and perhaps being accosted by an ultimate otherness, a demon, a shed. Then he realizes, oh, it's a woman. I don't know if that's much better, but it's maybe somewhat better. And here is a woman. And he says, Mi'at. He doesn't recognize her in the dark. So here is Ruth, unseen, unknown. She's a force in the darkness. There's no light at all. And he says, who are you? And she answers with great power, Anochi Rut Amatecha, Ufarasta Knafecha al Amitecha. I am Ruth, your maidservant, and you will spread your garment over your maidservant. Very modest, very humble, your maidservant. On the other hand, very assertive. This is who I am, and this is what you are going to do. She doesn't say please. She doesn't ask him. She says, you are going to spread your garment, which means really your protection. You're going to marry me. It's a sexual relationship. It's everything, the whole package. You know, she's made a bundle of it here. Ki go'el ata, for you are the Redeemer. And she tells him not only who she is, but who he is. You are destined to be my redeemer. You're going to get me out of this stranger place, this fated place where I am. And by saying it to him, she makes him into it. Suddenly he feels full force growing in him, that capacity to do what she said in the largest sense. And he says, blessed are you to God, my daughter. Your latter kindness is even better than your former kindness. That is, your kindness to your mother-in-law is dwarfed by your kindness to me. This is what Yarden spoke about, that it seems as if I'm being kind to you. I have everything to offer you. You have nothing. But in fact, in some intimate sense, you have everything to offer me. There's a different way of looking at the situation. There's something about her power and the kind of vision that she has of things that he feels that he is being graced by. in her relationship with him. What does the Midrash add up to all this? It's a fraught scene. What the Midrash adds is a most unexpected idea, which is really a Freudian idea before its time. Jumps to three generations ahead. The grandson of the baby of Ruth and Boaz at the end of the story is going to be King David. He is going to compose all his psalms at midnight. How do we know? Because he says so in one of his poems. Chatzot chatzi ha-layla, you see, quoted at the beginning of number 3. Chatzot layla akum lehodot lecha. At midnight, I rise up to give thanks to you, O God. And that becomes a description of his creative practice. This is how he writes his poetry and his music. Midnight hour chimes, or in terms of Midrashic tradition, there's a lyre or a harp over his bed. And when the midnight wind blows, it twangs the strings. And that's what wakes him up every midnight. And he sits down with his pen or his lyre or whatever, and he starts composing his. Why midnight? It becomes a ritual of remembrance and imagination. Because of that other midnight. Because of that midnight 3 generations ago, in which he, Boaz, was woken and shocked and anxious. Demonic possibilities were there. And he could very well have cursed her. But din haya sheikalalena. That's what you do when a demon accosts you, you know, on the threshing floor. After you've had a successful harvest, you say, "Get thee behind me, Satan." You know, you want to separate yourself absolutely from this unknown force. But somehow he overcame that impulse to curse, and instead he blessed her. Brucha at Lashem biti. Somehow something immediately switched. This is the flip that you were talking about in him. What is that flip? It's a most amazing passage, and it's spiritual poignancy. David identifies that flip. That was you, O God. What is that flip from cursing to blessing? Where you have a destructive impulse and you want to make space between you and the other person. You don't want to have anything to do with it. You're afraid. You're anxious. What is it that can flip that around? That's called God put it in my heart. That God put it in my heart to go against the normal and the predictable reaction, and to do something that's called pure chesed, pure courage, imagination, somehow going beyond the rituals of behavior. That is chesed. And what is this is all, of course, David's invention. Right? Who knows what Boaz really felt at that midnight hour, generations before? But David is using his imagination now, and he's saying there was a crucial moment then when I could have been absolutely barred from ever coming into the world. If he had cursed her, that would have been the end of that relationship. And then what would have happened with me? Me'ayin hayiti ba. Where would I then have come from? Now that's a ba. Notice the ba. How could I have made it across the taboos of all kinds into the world? I was enabled in coming into life, in entering into life, through the usual means, yes, through sexuality and fertility and so forth, by a moment of transformation, an inner moment of transformation. The legal process of allowing a Moabite to enter into the community of God in spite of everything, that's a separate issue, and I'm not even talking about that today. So the Midrash says that was the business of the courts. They dealt with that because they saw what a fine person Ruth was, and they made it somehow a space for that exception to the rule. But what we're interested in now is the inner work. What is it that made possible for David to come into the world? And he associates it with a moment of transformation, a very intimate moment, where just the opposite. Now, I want to say, just in a very briefly, that I think everyone has had a moment like this. That is, you've been brought up on information about how your parents met. And it usually depends on some kind of coincidence. You know, I just happened to be there, and I was just on the point of leaving, and she turned up, and then we talked, and that's how everything began. So what? And it's told as a wonder. You see, we almost missed each other. But then the child has to wonder if the child is a wondering kind, and I suppose most children are. But what would have happened to me if Daddy and Mummy had not met? If children have an instinct about that, they know, even before they know anything about genetics, they know that, of course, I had to be. There's no question about that. But actually, it would have been very easy to block my ever entering into the world. And so that's where song comes from, says the third of the poem. All David's songs are an expression of wonder at the unlikelihood of my ever making it in, into the world, into life, and here I am. Now, of course, there are other reasons for wondering at that. Every child is a miracle child on all kinds of levels. Right? Many children are in miracle children because of fertility issues with the parents. But even in the most normal of cases, you know, the statistics are not entirely always in one's favor, my personal favor. And so here is ground for song. Here is ground for celebration. That's the connection that the Midrash wants to set up. Why is Ruth called Ruth? The next source on your page, number 6. Where does the word Ruth, what does it relate to? It says that she's called Ruth because there emerged from her David, 3 generations later, who drenched God, rivahu. Leravot means to give a lot of liquid to someone who is thirsty. And what did David do? He saturated God, very physical word, with songs and praises. That is, David had this capacity for, in a way, feeding and nourishing the godly by his connection with God in the world of poetry, in the world of song and poetry. That's just what God wants. That's the one thing that God wants, is somehow to enter into the dream world, the fantasy world, the desire world of human beings who will create beauty of their connection with God. And David did this plentifully. So Ruth is given the credit of that saturating quality, Riva, and that's why she's called Ruth. Resh, Vav, Taf. It's the same root. It's the root of Ruth. The root of Ruth is Riva. Now, Ruth herself never wrote any songs and praises, as far as we know. It's only her great-grandson who did it. So why is she called Ruth? Because it came out of her. David came out of her, not just biologically, but somehow the intimacy of who she is. Right? She was a poet without knowing it, let's say. And you can hear it if you listen to how she speaks. We're not told that she's beautiful, right? People don't look at her and think, oh, what a beautiful woman. That's rather untypical of biblical heroines. Biblical heroines are usually described as gorgeously beautiful. You know, it's just a kind of politeness. When you have a biblical heroine, they have to be gorgeously beautiful. But Ruth is not described as beautiful. But I want to suggest that she speaks beautifully. There is something about the way she speaks, the language that she uses, that creates possibilities, that creates a world. You'd have to read closely to really fully appreciate what I want to say. And so now I have just a few minutes left, and I want to emphasize from now on something about Ruth that I mentioned before, and that is, it's a strange word, her stickiness. Verut dafkaba, and Ruth clung to her mother-in-law. That word, lidavik. Her sister-in-law kisses her goodbye, nice and clean, a clean cut, bye-bye. And she sticks to her. She doesn't allow any space between them. Clings. Now, the word lidavik has glorious associations. Atem hadvekim b'Hashem, chayim kulchem hayom. You who cling to God are all of you alive today. It's from the book of Deuteronomy, and we use it in the ritual, in the liturgy. That is, there is such a thing as clinging to God, which gives life. How can you cling to someone who is a raging fire? Asks the Midrash. God is fire, and we are flesh. So how can you get so close? How can you want to be attached to something that's so different from you? And yet, apparently, there are ways in which, imaginatively, and in a displaced way, we put things into our lives to express that yearning to become one with God, which we can never actually be. We can't actually be one. So that's a very elevated association. Another association, which is sexual, of course, is right at the beginning of the Genesis story, the creation story, that Adam and Eve, the future of men and women, is that a man will leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. A passionate attachment, v'davak b'ishto. So again, two who are different, you know, how can a man and a woman ever get together? I'm being a little silly here. You know, sometimes I really think that. You know, they're so different. How is it that there is this yearning always to come together? Well, that's how it is. That the otherness creates a certain kind of yearning, but it really can't be, the satisfaction can't be full and final. It can't actually allow for a kind of static state of being together. So there is a kind of attraction and repulsion. Jean-Paul Sartre talks about viscosity as an interesting texture. Viscosity is stickiness, like honey, like glue. He says it's liminal, it's somewhere in between solid and liquid. The good thing about solid and liquid is that you touch something. You can hold something in your hand and then let it go, and here you have your recognizable self. Your hand is recognizable and unchanged. You can let water run over your hands and still shake off the water afterwards, and you are unchanged. Nothing to be afraid of. But stickiness, if you get your hands in glue or in honey, there is a kind of repulsion. At least adults feel that repulsion. Children, on the other hand, Mary Douglas in her great book, Purity and Danger, talks about this. Children, on the other hand, love playing with sticky stuff. I won't enter into the details. Their earliest tactile adventures, Mary Douglas talks about. That is, they love the indeterminacy of it. The fact that their hands then become caked over with the sticky stuff, that they're not so sure anymore what is me and what is it, and they find themselves really transformed in interesting ways, but playing with possibilities. Now, as adults, we like to keep space between anything that encroaches on the limits of myself. I'm up to here, and you can be somewhere out there. And then there is this desire to overcome the boundaries, to go across the boundaries, and to play somewhere in that level, which arouses ambivalent feelings in the person you're trying to stick to. He doesn't know you. I want to say Boaz never actually knows Ruth before he marries her. How can he know her? She is totally different. And so what brings them together, I would say, is a kind of impersonal intimacy. An impersonal intimacy. It's an expression that I think says something, and with this we'll finish. Like, let's say, that there are relationships like this that are very common, like the relationship between a mother and a young child, a baby. Right? Passionate, intimate relationship, a new child, a new baby, but not personal, in the sense that personal is where you really know someone. You know their ways, you know how to please them, you know how to deal with them. A new baby is unknown to the mother, and the mother is unknown to the baby. And there they are, somehow strangely attuned to each other in their unknownness, fascinated in a way. The mother is fascinated not just with the baby as he is, but with the baby, what is coming, what is unknowably coming into being between the two of them. There's a process of newness that is moving towards the full growth of the baby, and she is part of it, and she knows herself differently from the way she's known herself up to now. Up to now, she may have had a very self-confident view of herself. I know exactly who I am in the world. There's nothing like a new baby for destabilizing that sense of I know very well who I am. Suddenly, my potential becomes from catastrophic to ecstatic, and one goes through the motions in the course of one day, probably many times along that spectrum. Suddenly, I'm not so sure who I am. Difficult experience. That's why it's hard for Ruth to be accepted into this new world. It's not in the end. It's not so clear that there's an unambivalent acceptance of her. On the other hand, the possibilities are endless. They could be, the messianic line could come of this. Somewhere David could come of this. The sense of the greatness of the possibilities. And I'll finish with a quotation from Edmond Jabez, who is a very provocative French philosopher and poet. And he says this, if I can find my quote. Yes, the foreigner allows you to be yourself by making a foreigner of you. The foreigner allows you to be yourself by making a foreigner of you. Yes. You think you're being kind to the foreigner, but actually the foreigner is giving you the gift of discovering your own foreignness, that you are not just what you've always known about yourself and what everyone knows about you. You're not just a pillar of society, that you have in you possibilities, shadowy possibilities, that this foreigner suddenly sheds light on, shows you things that you hadn't properly focused on before. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much to you both. I want to open our conversation between the two of you by picking up on something you mentioned, Aviva, impersonal intimacy, what it feels like to sort of encounter a person who's very different from you, and in recognizing that difference, there's also a sort of intimacy creative in that paradox in that encounter. Yarden, I'm wondering if you've ever experienced something like that in your work or sort of heard stories from the volunteers that work through Project 10, and if you could bring us into that kind of experience.
So I think it's something that happens a lot in our line of work. Like, we're in shelters or orphanages or homes of the people we're working with, and we're having a relationship with them. We're working with a single mother on a field in increasing the crops, and we're having lunch with them at the break in their house, and we see how they react to the children and how the children react to the mother, and it's like we're in there. We don't really know them. So it's a feeling of impersonal relationship. It's right there. It's seeing them many times inside the most difficult times, but still the feeling of not fully understanding what's all about, what's happening, what's going on here. There's a language barrier, but beyond the language barrier, we spend sometimes 6 months with a family, and really trying to work on a professional project. We're working with the family, for instance, the agriculture field, and we're part of the family, but we still feel we're inside outsider to this family.
I'm wondering if that's an experience that's unique to working in very different cultures, or if that experience echoes things that happen to us in our daily lives when we walk through the world within cultures where we're supposed to be insiders.
Are you asking me? Many times I feel like I'm an information collecting machine. Like, I'm trying to always reduce uncertainty when I'm walking around, like everywhere. Limud is my first limud. First in clients, there will be more. But I'm always trying to gather more and more information about who the person is standing in front of me. Who are you guys? Like, what's going on here? What is limud? How is this all working? Because it's very hard for me to be in uncertainty, and I feel it is an experience. Specifically when working in the developing areas, I feel I need to hold myself back from gathering information, or at least not making conclusions from the information that I'm gathering. Because my instinct is try to be as
clear-cut,
like know what I'm doing and who I am and what am I doing here, what am I doing there. But I try to, when I'm out there specifically, try not, like, to, if you put a number wise, not to go over the 80% of certainty. Kind of leave space to that. I don't really understand what's going on here. Like, many times we get a yes from the local community, because and later on we realize that the no is just impolite. So we can ask the people we're working with, do you want to go see a doctor tomorrow? We can meet at 11 o'clock. We have a few doctors who came in, and the person will say yes. The next day, he's not there. And you say, okay, he's coming again tomorrow. Do you want to see the doctor tomorrow? And they say, yes. And it's again like, it's not really a yes. And it's finding which yes is a yes and which yes is a no is part of leaving that open to not knowing.
I'm wondering if anything in what Yerdan just said reflects your experience of what it feels like to learn text ever.
Oh, yes. the feeling of not knowing is primary, and it has to be. That is, one of the good parts of getting older and more experienced and knowing more simply is that you know more. Is that you feel a little safer, you feel a little that you have been this way before, the things that one could say, you know, and so on. But I think the sheer terror and panic that comes of really not knowing, you know, that you don't really know what you really want to say about whatever you're studying. If that goes, then it's the end of the game, you know. Then if you really just become the experienced, knowing person, then it's not worth the candle. But I think that is definitely a certain terror, charada, exactly what Boaz experiences, a certain terror, anxiety, feeling of this is a strange text. And its strangeness is really the best part about it. You know, to try somehow to give some kind of fitting weight to that strangeness, you know, a way of holding it. A way of holding the strangeness and making it, giving it power in one's world.
Something I'm hearing in what both of you are saying is sort of in order to get to know both a text and a human who you don't know previously requires sort of an acknowledgement of the distance between you and that person in that text, and sort of in embracing what's unknown about where your encounter is going. Wonderful. I want to, before we open up for a couple minutes for questions from the audience, hear a little bit from both of you about the process of learning together, the encounter between you, and sort of bridging that gap of otherness there. What did each of you see in the text and in your work that you might not have otherwise if you hadn't approached learning it together?
Go ahead.
I think I got to know my son better. Rather, you know, I don't know if I saw the text differently, although it's just the experience of studying a text with someone whose life is different from one's own. And if it's my son, then, you know, there's a lot of complex feelings around it. And as I say, in the end, it's really joyful. But, you know, there are all kinds of feelings. Perhaps that desire for Dvekut, which is the first motherly desire, that is, that we should be absolutely one. I and any baby who comes to me should be absolutely one. And then having to acknowledge that can't be, that the baby will go on to become his own person. And tov shekach, you know, that's actually the best thing that can happen. But here there was a very intimate knowledge of the terrain here as we worked together. So I began to know his mind better.
So I grew up in the yeshiva world till I was 21. And then I had a process of, say like go back with a question, but I don't know if that is, it's like more like shooting out and then shooting out of religion. And it was a painful process, I think, for maybe more for you, but you know, it was a painful process of becoming a non-practicing Jew, which over the years I've found my own ways of. And I think the last time we studied together that I remember, and I think there were other times as well, was for the bar mitzvah, and it was very very frustrating, very frustrating process. Yeah, and I think it was kind of a closing of a circle, but kind of like finding a new place we can connect on. I think we were terrified. I was terrified of, and caused a lot of anxiety. The process also starting like really not knowing where this is going. We decided to study the text with no not knowing what's going to happen from it. It was a new way of studying together. That was not a Talmudic way from yeshiva. It was like something else.
I have an analogy. Do I have a moment?
Please.
Yes. I decided I'll tell this story. It's a kind of personal story. Our other great adventure together was that we went to India together quite a few years ago. And there was one particular incident that stays in my mind in which he wanted to go on a hike. We were in Dharamsala, and he wanted to, and it's the Himalayas. He wanted to go on a hike, and I'm not one of the great hikers. And so what we did was we took a taxi with two wheels hanging over the edge of the cliff, and we got to this place that's known to be a vantage point where you can see extraordinary views. And he left me there. He parked his mother there. And
with a book.
With a book. And he went off on a hike. And he assured me he'd be back before sunset. And I was left there, basically alone, although every now and then a jolly group of hikers would pass by. And I lived in faith that he would indeed turn up before sunset. Meantime, I had one of the great experiences of my life. I was alone in the presence of this extraordinary vista. I've never seen such a big world before. And he did turn up before sunset. So, you know, there we have it.
Thank you so much. I'm going to break from Limud tradition and give us 5 more minutes, if you'll join, so that we'll have an opportunity for a couple of questions. Because this is in your namesake, I'm going to give one to Ruth.
So I'm delighted. I'm delighted you're discussing Ruth in this context. I've said 3 very quick comments. First of all, Jordan, you just said you're a non-practicing Jew, so from my perspective, you're practicing Judaism. In your observation about what it's like to be in another culture, at American Jewish World Service, we teach people, including ourselves, all the time, and this I think relates directly to text study, to distinguish between the observation, good, the question, excellent, and the assumption, bad. So that, in other words, very often we observe something and then we make our own assumption about it, which comes out of our own culture and our own orientation, and is usually not helpful. Asking a question is better. But what I mostly want to say, and I just read it again, Aviva, that the last quote you gave us about the foreigner directly explains the issue that you raised at the end of your presentation, Jan, which is why did they want you back? Even after you thought you left the project, because in having someone else come to be with you and to work with you and to help you make change makes you see yourself in an entirely different light. And they didn't want to lose that so quickly. So I think it's a beautiful connection.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Forgive me for being intrusive, but you said something about Ruth having David in him.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't acknowledge that you had him in you, so he's...
Oh, I do. Yes, but thank you, yes. That's a very nice...
Yeah. No, it's limud ha-mevili de-mase. Like it's a limud ha-mevili de-mase.
Study brings to practice. Study brings out then potential. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's today's conversation. Stay tuned for more Global Torah Live and catch up on our first season at olamtogether.org and elmad.pardes.org. Global Torah was created in partnership between the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies and Olam. Special thanks to the Olam and Pardes teams, to Ben Wallach and Seth Samuel, to our friends at Limud UK, and to the Zornberg family for sharing your insights. Olam is a joint venture of the Alliance for Global Good, Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Foundation, and Paris Foundation. Learn more at olamtogether.org.